would like to welcome you all to this patient and caregiver call titled Introduction to Epilepsy and Seizures. This is our first call for patient and caregivers. My name is Sean Gamble. I am with the Employee Education Service here in St. Louis, and I am the project manager for this series of calls. All your lines are going to be muted and will be opened up at the end of the presentation when we're ready for questions and answers. I want to introduce today Dr. Nina Garga. She's going to be talking about Introduction to Epilepsy and Seizures. Dr. Garga, it's all yours.
Thank you, Sean. I'm going to spend most of today talking about some of the basics about what are seizures, what are some of the symptoms of
someone has entered the conference.
What does it mean to have epilepsy? How is that diagnosis made? What are some of the treatment options? So that's just a really brief overview of what we'll cover today. I work at the San Francisco VA Epilepsy Center with
someone has entered the conference
taking care of patients who have seizures and epilepsy. So just a real basic introduction, what is a seizure? Well, a seizure is sometimes called an electrical storm. It's basically a brief temporary disturbance of the electrical activity of the brain. Now, the brain has electrical activity going on constantly. It's how we control movement, vision, all of our other senses.
Someone has entered the conference.
So when a seizure happens, there is dysregulation of the normal activity, and too much activity happens all at once from either a part of the brain or the whole brain. And that can happen out of the blue with no warning. And be completely unpredictable. Now, epilepsy is actually a disorder that's characterized by having recurring seizures. Some people call it a seizure disorder, but we essentially use the two words interchangeably. So seizure disorder generally means epilepsy. And it can be for any number of reasons that somebody has recurrent seizures. So who has epilepsy? Well, over 2 million Americans have it, and about 200,000 new cases of seizures and epilepsy occur every year. About half of people with epilepsy start having seizures before they turn 25 years old, but anyone can get it at any time. And now there's just as many people with epilepsy who are 60 or older as there are children aged 10 and younger with epilepsy. So even though traditionally a lot of people think of epilepsy as happening to children or babies, this is really a disease that affects all sorts of people at all ages. So about 1% of the general population develops epilepsy.
Someone has entered the conference.
The risk is higher in people with certain medical conditions. These include traumatic brain injury, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, autism, brain tumors, or other abnormalities of blood vessels. But that's just a small group of disorders that can lead to it. There are a whole bunch of other problems or injuries that can lead to epilepsy. So what causes epilepsy? Well, in about 70% of people with epilepsy, we don't know. We don't know why they have it. We have some vague idea based on risk factors or genetics, but it's not always very clear. In about a third of patients, we can identify the exact cause as being head trauma or an old infection of the brain, a brain tumor or stroke, or genetics in general that it runs in their family. And in some cases, we can even find the gene involved that's causing it. So how do we identify what is a seizure and what are some of the symptoms of a seizure? Well, to know that, you have to first know that there are several different types of seizures. There are what we call partial seizures and generalized seizures. Now, that's a very simple distinction to basically distinguish what happens during the seizure. So for a partial seizure, only a part of the brain is involved, and that's why it's called partial. It's usually in one focal area, and the symptoms during the seizure will be basically some disruption associated with that part of the brain's
normal. Someone has entered the conference.
So, for instance, if the area causing the seizure is in the visual part of the brain that controls seeing and vision and processing of vision, then a seizure that starts there may have symptoms such as flashing lights or strange patterns in the vision. For other people who have partial seizures that originate in other parts of the brain, such as the frontal lobe where motor control is, they may have twitching or jerking of the body on the opposite side. And for people who have seizures that start in the temporal lobe of the brain, that tends to be involved more with memory or with other psychic phenomena. So some people experience symptoms like deja vu or confusion or just an inability to respond while they stare ahead and cannot interact. So those are some examples of partial seizures. There are many other possibilities for how they may begin, but that's just a small subset of examples. The other major type of seizure is a generalized seizure. Now, when people say, "I had a seizure," most people think of a generalized seizure where the whole body is convulsing. So we often call a generalized seizure a convulsive seizure. We frequently refer to it also as a generalized tonic-clonic seizure, which just means that the body is very stiff at the beginning, and then it begins to jerk rhythmically until it ends. Now, what I've explained to you so far is a little bit of an oversimplification, and there are actually several other seizure types that may fit in either category, so it's not necessarily completely as straightforward as that. But the very basics is that seizures are either focal or they're generalized. Some seizures can begin as a focal seizure and then spread. The electrical activity can spread throughout the brain and become a generalized seizure that involves the entire brain at once. The reason that it's important for your doctor to know whether it starts in one area or starts in the whole brain is that it can affect our thought process on what has caused your seizure disorder or your loved one's seizure disorder, as well as affect what medications we might choose to treat it, because there are differences in how we approach those two types of seizures. So what patients and what caregivers should know about symptoms that may indicate somebody has a seizure disorder, they should look for things like periods of a patient blacking out or being confused with altered memory. They may have completely forgotten that certain things happened. They may have occasional fainting spells, or especially in children or some adults, may have episodes of blank staring. Sometimes a seizure can present as a sudden fall that happens for no apparent reason. And also there can be episodes of just blinking or chewing at inappropriate times. Now, I understand that after describing all of these, probably most of us can think of any time that we've done one of these things. It doesn't mean that any time somebody falls for no apparent reason that it's a seizure, but these are just some of the symptoms that can occur, and if they're happening repeatedly in the same person, it can really start to point at either some type of neurological disorder or specifically a seizure disorder. And it's important to note these things because not all seizures are the big seizures where you convulse and jerk. So why might people have seizures? Well, I've talked about some of the risk factors, having a brain injury or a stroke or another process going on in the brain, or we just don't know. But in any person who has a tendency to have seizures, are there certain things that make them more likely to have a seizure today or tomorrow, but not a week from now? There definitely are. Although seizures are unpredictable and can happen at any time, there are certain things that may trigger a seizure in somebody who has epilepsy or has a tendency to have seizures. Those types of things can include missing their medications, which is actually the number one reason that somebody with epilepsy has a seizure, is because they forgot to take their medicine or ran out of medicine. Other triggers can be things like stress or anxiety, hormonal changes, especially in women who are having menstrual cycles, dehydration, and changes in your body's electrolyte balance can definitely trigger a seizure. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody should go out and start drinking Gatorade, but definitely drinking enough water and staying hydrated is really important. Lack of sleep or being extremely fatigued is very well known to cause seizures in people with the tendency. In fact, it can even cause a seizure in a a person without epilepsy who may be extremely sleep-deprived or exhausted. Photosensitivity, so flashing lights and bright lights, can sometimes cause seizures in certain types of seizure disorders. And also, very importantly, drug and alcohol use or interactions with medications can cause seizures. Various drugs can cause seizures directly, and other things like alcohol can either trigger seizures or trigger them when the alcohol is wearing out of your body. A lot of medications can cause seizures as a side effect, or specifically if you take two medicines that interact with each other, sometimes the end result can be a seizure. So it's important to know this and that your seizure doctor knows what all your medicines are, so they can help tell you if you're on a medication that might be making your seizure disorder worse, and look towards changing that. So what should you do if you're seeing somebody having a seizure? Well, the first thing to do is not to panic. It's important to stay calm and track the time. You don't want to restrain the person, but you want to help them avoid hazards. So you should protect their head, remove their glasses, and maybe loosen any tight items of clothing around their neck. You should move anything hard or sharp out of the way and turn the person on their side. Excuse me. And position their mouth towards the ground so that they don't swallow if they're foaming at the mouth or vomiting. You want to look and see if they're wearing a bracelet, an ID bracelet that indicates that they have epilepsy or a seizure disorder. And you should also know that if you tell them what to do, they may not understand verbal instructions during or after a seizure for quite some time. You want to stay with them until that person is fully aware and help reorient them. And if the seizure lasts a long time, such as more than 5 minutes, or if it's a person who you don't know if they've ever had a prior seizure, you should call 911 or an ambulance. So what should you not do if somebody's having a seizure? There are a lot of things that can be dangerous to the person. So you should not put anything in the person's mouth. They could bite down on your fingers and injure you as well, and it's not likely to help them. Preventing them from swallowing their tongue or biting their tongue is really not advisable if you have to put something in their mouth. You know, there's an old adage that you should stick a leather wallet or something in their teeth so they don't hurt themselves, but that's really more dangerous than it is helpful, especially if it's something small. They can swallow it or they could break their teeth on it. So it's better to help get them on their side so that they don't swallow their vomit, rather than putting something in their mouth. You should not give them any of their seizure medicines by mouth while they are having a seizure, especially if it's one where they're convulsing. You know, doctors will sometimes give other instructions to patients and caregivers in very specific situations that may be safer, but you, in general, unless you've been instructed on a specific way to do this, you should not give pills somebody having a seizure, especially during one. You should keep the person on their back with their face up or on their side with their head protected, depending on how severe the seizure is. So when should you call 911 or emergency medical services? Well, like I said before, if a person is having a convulsive seizure, when they've never had a seizure before or you don't know if they've had a seizure before, you should call. Or if they're having a seizure that lasts more than 5 minutes, even if you know they have epilepsy, When it lasts more than 5 minutes, it can be more serious and they may need immediate medical attention. If somebody is having a focal seizure, like I described earlier, where they're not convulsing, but they are clearly impaired in their awareness, you don't always have to call 911, but if it's lasting a long time, like more than 5 minutes, you should probably call 911. If you know the patient and they typically have very long focal seizures lasting 10 minutes, that's okay if that's the normal duration for that individual. And you don't have to call 911 necessarily if that's the typical amount of time it takes for their seizures to pass and their doctor knows it and they're working on a plan. But anything that you think is beyond usual in terms of the length of the focal seizure, then you should consider calling for help. Another reason to call 911 is if a patient has one seizure and then they have another seizure before they've recovered in between them. So if a person is having a convulsion and the convulsion ends and they're tired and they're starting to come around, but they haven't really come around yet, and then they have another convulsion, that can be a very serious medical emergency, and you should definitely call 911. Also, if the person is injured from the seizure or pregnant, it would be important to call. If you know that they have diabetes or another medical condition, it's definitely worth calling, because sometimes even the emergency medical personnel can give them an injection of sugar or some other type of treatment that may be important to help them recover completely and not continue to have seizures. If the person is recovering too slowly, you can call 911 if you're concerned that this is not normal, or for them if you know them, or if it's somebody you don't know and they're recovering slowly. Or if they don't resume their normal pattern of breathing. When you're in doubt, if you really don't know, the best thing to do is to call for help. So moving away from the seizure safety, when you see the doctor, how do they diagnose epilepsy? Like I mentioned to you before, sometimes the symptoms are a little bit unclear and can be as mild as having episodes of loss of memory or loss of time. So what we do when we see you in the clinic is we take a very careful history from both the patient and the caregiver, somebody who's witnessed the seizures, to get a very accurate description of what the seizures are like and what the pattern has been over the previous, you know, weeks and months. We try to get a lot of information about whether there's any risk factors for seizures, and if any other testing has already been done. Then we examine the patient, performing a neurological exam to see if there's any features on the exam that help point us towards a seizure disorder or a neurological problem that might cause a seizure disorder. And by the end of the visit, if necessary, we order tests, which can include blood tests, tests of the brain waves called an EEG, imaging tests to look at pictures of the brain, and that can be either a CAT scan or an MRI or a PET scan. And we use all that information to try to come to a conclusion about whether the person has epilepsy. And now remember I said that epilepsy is a tendency to have recurrent seizures. So if a patient has only had one seizure, sometimes we're not always sure after doing all of that whether they have epilepsy or whether they're likely to have another seizure. But the goal of doing all of that evaluation and tests is to figure out whether this is going to happen again and whether we can do anything to control it or cure it. So what should you tell your doctor about your seizures? Well, you should describe your symptoms and have witnesses or caregivers describe the symptoms that they see. Should definitely explain the seizure pattern. Some people will know that they have about one seizure a week or one seizure a month. All that information is really helpful. Also, knowing whether there's any other pattern related to sleep or intake of certain medications or drugs is very helpful for your doctor to know. You want to tell them if there's any pre-seizure activity. Now, what do I mean by that? You want to tell them if you have any symptoms that indicate that you think you're going to have a seizure, or if you're a caregiver, if you've witnessed any sort of symptoms that tend to occur before the patient has a seizure again and again. Sometimes we use the word aura to describe that activity. You also want to tell the doctor if you're on a medication and whether that medication is working for you and how well you're able to take your medicine on time every day. It's really important to keep a seizure record or a seizure diary, and this can be as simple as having a little pocket calendar where you mark the days that you had seizures, or your caregiver marks the days that you had seizures. Keeping that record makes it a lot easier to work with your doctor on adjusting medication doses to better control them and to get an idea of whether what we've already done is working. So what's the goal of treatment in epilepsy? Well, we like to reach a point where a patient is having zero seizures or as few seizures as possible. So we call that seizure freedom. And we also try to achieve seizure freedom with no side effects from anti-seizure medicines. Now, that's not always possible, so sometimes we'll allow some side effects if they're acceptable to the patient, as well as overall in terms of looking at issues with medications causing side effects that we think are not acceptable. So the goal is seizure freedom and no side effects, or as close to that as possible. And we want to help the person with epilepsy lead a full and productive life. This doesn't have to be something that runs your life. So how do we decide who needs to be on medication or needs treatment in general for seizures? Well, a lot of that has to do with the pattern of what's happened up until the point where we meet with you. So for patients where we might not give them treatment or seizure medication, they might be people who have only had one seizure and we're not convinced that they're going to have another seizure, and it may be better to wait and see. If the patient is neurologically normal, meaning when we do our neuro exam, we can't find anything abnormal, then we might not rush to treat. Also, if a patient is younger, it may not be as urgent to treat, and we may wait and see what happens. Also, if we're more concerned about side effects from medications in certain individuals, we may balance whether or not it's worth treating. For patients that we do want to treat more aggressively early on are the ones who we order some tests on, such as the EEG, and it's abnormal, and it suggests that they're very likely to have another seizure. For patients who have already had several seizures, we're more likely to treat. And actually, the patients with focal seizures that start in one area of the brain, we're more likely to treat because those have a tendency to recur more often. Even if the patient has only had one seizure, if they are a driver and they want to resume driving, we will often treat with medications to help achieve that goal faster. We also consider whether the patient is elderly and if they have other neurological diseases that may be leading to the epilepsy, we may be more likely to treat. But all in all, a lot of it is a risk-benefit analysis and looking at the individual and why we think they have seizures and if it's something that we can modify with treatment. So what are the types of treatment? Well, I've mentioned medications, which is really the mainstay of treatment for seizures and epilepsy, but there are also some other treatments such as surgery or other non-medication treatments like special diets or devices such as the vagus nerve stimulator, and other lifestyle modifications. And I'm going to go through these in a little bit more detail over the next 15 minutes or so. But when I say lifestyle modifications, what do I mean? I mean getting very regular sleep and trying to do some stress reduction in your life so that the seizures are less likely to come back, or doing things like reducing or eliminating drug and alcohol intake. So getting back to medications, there are about 15 to 20 different seizure medications out there on the market. There are so many to choose from that it may be hard to figure out why did your doctor pick one drug versus another. So some of the factors that can affect which medication we choose include the type of seizures or the epilepsy syndrome. Now, remember I mentioned that focal seizures and generalized seizures don't always respond to the same medicines, so that can really help us pick a drug or at least eliminate some options. We also look at the side effects of each drug. Every single medication we have can cause side effects, but they often cause different, each one causes different side effects. So sometimes we try to match up a medication that has a certain side effect with something that a patient can tolerate, or some actually a positive side effect that may work in their favor. For instance, some seizure medicines are sedating, and for a patient who has insomnia a lot of the time and trouble sleeping, we may actually pick one that's sedating if it's taken at bedtime. Or for other medicines, may actually cause some difficulty sleeping, and patients may like that if they're on other medicines that are making them feel too sedated. So you can see how we can try to use the side effect to our advantage sometimes. Other seizure medicines also tend to help with headaches or migraines, so that may help us pick a medicine if the patient also has a headache disorder. We look at the patient's age, not just when we pick a drug, but also when we pick how much of it to put you on. We look at your lifestyle. You know, if you're working and or a student and you're having to constantly think and be on your feet and, you know, maybe even deliver care to other people, we have to be very careful about not giving sedating medicines or medicines that may make you feel like you're thinking slower. A few other points, if it's a woman who is thinking about having children or is at that age where they might have children, whether or not they want to, intended or not, we may choose certain medicines that are less likely to cause problems for the fetus. So there's a whole lot of things that we take into account when we take a medicine. One of the things that I always think about is, what other medications is this person taking? And if I give them one medicine, will it interact with the other pill? Will it make the other pill not work as well? Or will the other pill not make it work as well? So that those are a lot of decisions that go into choosing a medicine. So once we pick a medicine, what are some of the things that might make the medicine work for you or not work for you? Well, most important is consistent use of the medicine. So taking it as prescribed, and trying your best not to miss doses. That's probably the most important thing that influences whether the medicine controls the seizures. But there's other things as well. So it may be that the dose is not high enough, or that it's just not the right medication for your individual seizure disorder or seizure type. Sometimes there's an issue with the medication itself, and for some reason that doesn't work with other medications a person is taking or for their particular disease. So in about half of people, if you start them on a medication, the seizures will be eliminated. In about another 30% of patients, the seizures will be reduced, but they may not be completely eliminated. And then in about 20% of patients with any given medicine, the seizures will not respond well. And it's really hard to know up front which category any given person will be in, and so sometimes it feels a little bit like trial and error and working towards finding the right medicine for the right person. So we talked about seizure control from the medicines and taking a medicine, but what are the side effects? I mentioned that feeling drowsiness or having difficulty sleeping are some common side effects. Other common side effects of a lot of our medicines can be feeling clumsy or irritable or nauseated. Another one is getting a rash or an allergic reaction. the side effects are sometimes related to the dose of medicine you're taking, and it may be that lowering the dose can get rid of the side effects but still keep seizure control. So developing a side effect doesn't necessarily mean that we can't find a way to give you the same medicine but in a different way or a different dose to help your seizures. It's also important, if you have a side effect, to know whether it's a side effect that should make you stop the medicine or if it's a side effect that you just need to report and then make a plan with your doctor on how to lower the dose in a way that won't make you have a lot of seizures but will help you get rid of the side effect. Some warning signs of possible serious side effects for which you should always call your doctor right away and even consider going to an emergency room for immediate attention would include things like rash along with nausea and vomiting, a severe sore throat or mouth ulcers, if you're having a prolonged fever, easy bruising or bleeding in different parts of the body. We call it pinpoint bleeding, so under the skin. Having a lot of weakness or fatigue, having swollen glands, and a lack of appetite or abdominal pain can also be serious. So those are things that you shouldn't wait a month or two till your next appointment with your doctor to talk about. Those are things that warrant an immediate call and potentially emergency care. The other ones that I talked about, like the clumsiness, drowsiness, irritability, those types of side effects, you know, of course you should always call your doctor and try to discuss it as soon as possible, but they may not be as emergent as the other ones I mentioned. So moving away from medicines, I mentioned that surgery is sometimes an option for treating epilepsy. So what are some of the factors that influence whether or not we want to offer surgery to a patient? Well, one, the first thing, the most important thing, is we have to determine how likely is it that the seizures are due to epilepsy. And this gets back to the whole issue of what is just a seizure and what is epilepsy. So for us to determine that the seizures are electrical activity from the brain that's abnormal and that that's what's going on consistently, is important for us to decide that surgery is even an option. Then we have to decide if surgery is likely to help this in an individual situation and whether we can identify the focus that's causing the seizures. We have to think about whether other treatments have been attempted and have simpler treatments been tried. So has the person even tried a medication or tried a couple of medicines? That's really important because something like taking a medicine may be a better option than surgery. It just depends on the circumstances for the individual. And then we have to think of the overall risks and benefits. You know, doing surgery is not a simple thing, and there are definitely risks that go along with having any surgery, as well as specific risks to removing a part of the brain that's causing seizures. And, you know, part of the evaluation leading up to surgery is looking at how risky will this be for this patient and is it worth it? And that is not an easy question to answer. It is very individual and it's based on a lot of time and testing done with your doctor. But that being said, for some patients, surgery is definitely an option and it's often the best treatment for their epilepsy. So it's definitely something that you should discuss with your doctor. I mentioned something called a vagus nerve stimulator. Now, what this device is something that's used to treat epilepsy, and it's different than a medication. It's actually a wire that's placed in the neck over the vagus nerve. It's right next to the place where you can feel your pulse in your neck. And that wire has some points on it that deliver electrical stimulation to the nerve. And somehow that electrical stimulation affects the brain and changes some of the electrical activity over long periods of time to try to reduce seizures. And the doctor can control how much electrical stimulus is given by programming it and changing the settings. So this treatment, I'll call it VNS for short, is used to treat partial seizures or focal seizures when medications don't work. And if surgery, other types of surgery aren't an option or aren't a good option. and it often reduces seizures, but it rarely completely controls them. It's a different situation in children who have certain types of epilepsy. The VNS can actually control the seizures much better, or at least control the disabling seizures. So it's definitely worth discussing, just like other medications and surgery. It's definitely not for everybody, but it can be a very good choice for select patients. And that's definitely something we can do at the San Francisco VA and at many institutions around the country and in the Bay Area. So diet. What can people do with their diets that can sometimes help control seizures? Well, it was learned a long time ago that patients who were starving, or people who were undergoing starvation, that they had an anti-epileptic effect. So if you had a seizure patient who happened to be starving, they had fewer seizures. Now, we don't want to make our patients starve, but when somebody is starving, what they're doing is they're burning fat for energy instead of sugar. And you may have heard of the Atkins diet, but there's another diet called the ketogenic diet, which is kind of similar to the Atkins diet, where you basically trick your body into thinking that it's starving by adjusting the ratio of fats, proteins, and carbohydrates in the diet, and putting the body into that state of thinking it's starving when it's not actually starving can sometimes help reduce the seizures. So we use this diet mostly to treat severe epilepsy in children, but in some adults and adolescents it can be effective. But it's a very difficult diet to stick with, so it can only be done if somebody's making a strong commitment, both the patient and their caregivers, to working on staying within the diet. A lot of the times this diet is started in the hospital to help transition the patient into that state of starvation, and then continued on the outside after they go home. So I just wanted to make a couple comments on epilepsy in very specific populations, and I touched on this a little bit already, but I wanted to talk about epilepsy in women. I mentioned that hormonal effects can affect seizures. Now, hormones change during puberty, menopause, and regular monthly cycles in menstruating women. And the changes between estrogen and progesterone and the cycles that people go through can definitely affect seizure frequency. So a lot of women will say, oh, my seizures always get worse or more frequent, you know, the few days before my period or a few days after my period. And that's normal to notice that variation. It doesn't happen for everybody, but it can happen. An important thing to remember is that birth control pills may not be as effective in women who have epilepsy and who are taking medications to control the seizures. So that's something that we have to consider when we take care of women who don't want to get pregnant and also have epilepsy. A lot of our medications, as I mentioned before, can be risky if a patient is pregnant or breastfeeding. These medications can increase the risk for birth defects. Not all of them, but many of them do, and it's an important conversation to have with your doctor if you're pregnant or thinking about coming pregnant. It's important for us to be able to adjust your medications or your doses and come up with the best combination to make both the patient with epilepsy and their fetus safe. I do want to stress, though, that any woman who's pregnant should not necessarily stop their seizure medicines because having a seizure can also be a risk to the fetus. So it's a risk-benefit analysis again. So epilepsy in older adults is also a little bit of a special group of people I wanted to mention. One of the reasons is that older adults can have focal seizures that are often unrecognized or misdiagnosed, so it can be a little bit hard to assess. Also, our medications, sometimes the same dose that works for somebody who's 40 years old is just too much medicine for a patient who's 70. And so a lot of times they end up on the same doses and they have a lot of side effects. So we we definitely treat older adults a little bit differently when they have seizures, and we have to take certain things into consideration. Now, finally, one thing that people have a lot of questions about is driving. So if I have seizures or if I have epilepsy, can I drive a car? And every time I think about this, I remember when I was 16 years old and getting my license, that the little book that the DMV makes has, you know, in big print across the front and the back, driving is a privilege, it is not a right. And, you know, this is a real problem because we live in a society where being able to drive means being able to be independent. And it's a really big deal, and it's a very difficult thing to deal with. So what should you know? Well, every state has different laws about driving in epilepsy. In California, any patient who's had a seizure with loss of awareness or loss of consciousness must be reported to the Department of Public Health. Now, that's the same department that we report infectious diseases to and other things for epidemics. But basically, your doctor is required by law to report you to the Department of Public Health if you've had a seizure where you've lost awareness or consciousness. If they don't report you, they can go to jail. So it is not a small thing. It's something that has to be done, unfortunately, you know, and it puts us in a tough position. But this is done for your safety as well as the safety of the public. Now, once the Department of Public Health has been informed, they inform the DMV, and the patient usually gets a packet of paperwork in the mail that they have to fill out with their doctor, and a hearing gets arranged for that patient to see a driver medical evaluation doctor that's hired through the DMV. And ultimately, that medical officer that's through the DMV is going to decide whether that patient's license gets suspended and or when they get it back. Now, your doctor does have input because they fill out this form with you, you know, but it's not their final decision. In most states, the DMV wants to know that you have been seizure-free for about 6 months, and that can be either on medicine or off medicine, before they lift a suspension on your license. Now, there's definitely variation. Some states have 3 month waiting periods, others have 12 month waiting periods. And in a lot of cases, your doctor may say that, you know, for special reasons, they should wait longer or a shorter time for any individual patient. And that can be guided by how hard your epilepsy is to treat, or how difficult it is for you to stay on medication. So I just wanted to conclude by saying that, you know, our goal, again, is to let patients live full, productive, happy lives, even if they have epilepsy and a seizure disorder. So I want you to remember that you may have epilepsy, but epilepsy doesn't have you, and so we want to work together with you to make your life as good as possible while you're dealing with this disease. So I'm going to open it up for questions and answers in just a moment. Or anything they want to discuss.
Yes. You were talking about misdiagnosis of symptoms and treatments in older adults.
Yes.
Can you give me some examples of...
Sure. Okay. So a lot of times, so I'll give you one example. This may not apply, but a lot of patients who have conditions like Alzheimer's disease or dementia may have episodes of, you know, confusion or lapses in memory. And a lot of times we think, oh, that's just the dementia. But actually a subset of patients with dementia do develop seizures. And there are those focal seizures where all that may happen is that they may stare or be non-responsive. And so it can be really hard to tell, is that the dementia or is that a seizure? So that's one example.
And is there like a certain age where these things become permanent and it'll never change even with medication? How does that work?
Oh, that's a very good question. Seizures and epilepsy have a natural history. In some people, they can grow out of them with age, so in fact, getting older can help. And in other patients, they can get worse with age. But it's very individual, so I would never say that, oh, if you still have seizures by the time you're 70, you're always going to have seizures, or it's definitely going to get worse the older you get. In fact, you know, medications may control them completely. Now, you may have to stay on medications for most of your life, but other people can come off of medicines after a few years, even if they're, you know, 65, 70, 80, and stop having seizures.
Yeah, I'm really referring to the dementia and confusion side of things.
Okay.
Like you were talking about freezing for periods and misdiagnosis of that.
Not being certain about diagnosis. So when somebody has, you know, memory problems or freezing episodes, sometimes those get worse over time with epilepsy, and sometimes they actually get better. You know, the underlying process, if somebody has dementia, may continue to get worse, but actually as some of those connections in the brain change with the progression, sometimes the epilepsy actually goes away. So having a progressive disorder like dementia doesn't always mean that the seizures get worse with it.
Okay.
It's variable.
So, yeah, I know situations are very individual for every person that's on it, or has it, rather.
Exactly.
What about, like, freedom to be able to live your own life and not be beholden to everything that your doctor says? Or I know you said that it's good to have a constant amount of sleep and have your drugs on time and that. But
that's really hard. I think I understand what you're asking. You know, do you have to do everything your doctor says? Do you have to follow such a regimented lifestyle? You know, that makes it really hard to have, you know, the life that you want. And I think that's a tough question. I think it's all a balance between getting what you want out of life and, you know, being safe. So I think that doctors often recommend things very specifically. And, you know, as a patient, it is sort of up to you how much of that you want to do. The problem is that if people have ongoing seizures that aren't controlled, there can be serious injury or even death associated with seizures, and so we try our best to recommend what we think should be done. And, you know, but it's definitely an individual choice how much of that you want to accept.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
You can. Yes. I wonder if this gentleman is through with his question. All right. What is the medication of choice? Hello.
Sorry.
Yes.
Go ahead with your question.
What is the medication of choice for absence seizures?
So absence seizures usually occur in children or adolescents, and that there is one medicine that is used most often when it occurs in children and adolescents. It's called ethosuximide. However, if a person has absence seizures but also has convulsive seizures or multiple seizure types, which a lot of people with absence seizures do have, then sometimes they choose a different medicine called Depakote, which has a couple other names, but it's basically valproic acid. But there are actually two or three other options, and it kind of depends on who the person is and, you know, if they're a woman or a man and whether there's risk, you know, things like that.
All right, and what's the predominance of absence seizures in adults, in the adult
So it's actually not that prominent unless it started as a child. But I should probably clarify one thing, is that a lot of doctors will say you have absence seizures, or that may be a term that people use in the public, but what they really mean sometimes is that you're having focal seizures where you're staring or not responding. So in children, an absence seizure means that there's a couple of seconds where you're blinking and not responding and you lose awareness, and then you immediately return to normal. And those can happen hundreds of times a day, and that's an absence seizure. But a lot of people will use the word absence seizure to indicate a focal seizure where somebody is staring and not responding for a minute or two, and that's very different. So the treatment by medicine is actually very different if you're having the focal seizures where you're just impaired in your awareness. So those are actually not, it's not common to have the true absence seizures as an adult unless you've had them since childhood or adolescence.
I see.
Yeah.
All right,
so that's, you know, a lot of people will say I have petit mal seizures, and people, like the traditional petit mal seizure is an absence seizure, but most people use them to describe any seizure, whether it's absence or focal, where you're just kind of confused or out of it.
I see. All right, thank you very much.
Other questions?
I seem to have a lot of absence seizures or focal seizures where it's like blink and they're gone, and sometimes it's a state of confusion where I can't, I know the word in my head, but I can't get my mouth to say it, things like that, you know?
I think those symptoms can definitely be a seizure, but sometimes they're not, and when it gets confusing, especially like you were saying, when you're older and have memory problems and you're not sure if it's a seizure and your doctor's not sure, there is some type of testing that we can do to distinguish it. And that involves being in the hospital for several days and trying to trigger the events and capture them and record the brain waves. Sometimes that can actually make the diagnosis.
Is this an EEG?
It's an EEG, but it's done with glue instead of paste on your head. So you glue the electrodes on and you stay on the EEG with the video camera, you know, for 3 to 7 days in the hospital. And a lot of times if you're on seizure medicine, they reduce them during the test to try to see what the seizures or what the episodes are like and to figure out if there are seizures or not. Because the problem is if they're not seizures and they're raising your medicine, your seizure medicine to try to control them, it can give you a lot of dangerous side effects and not help you at all. So that's why the test is sometimes done.
Happened to that. Which?
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of centers around the country that can do that testing. We're one of them, both at VAs as well as at other universities and even some private groups. So it's pretty readily available in many parts of the country.
Thank you. Do you know anything about side effects of drug Vimpat?
Yes. So Vimpat is a relatively new drug that was approved by the FDA, I think, about 1 to 2 years ago. And the other name for it is lacosamide. Now, that medicine is pretty new. The most common side effect on it that people report is dizziness. And, you know, I've used that medicine with a couple of patients here at San Francisco VA, and one of them for sure had a lot of dizziness on it, and another one didn't. So it can happen to some and not others. But it has very few side effects beyond that, at least as far as we know so far. And it's a pretty safe medicine to mix with other pills, so there's very few interactions.
People in my epilepsy group have told me that it's very individual, and some people have great results on it. Totally free of seizures, and others get like hearing loss and other strange side effects or something.
Huh.
How?
I would agree with that. That it can be very individual.
And is there any way to predict or?
You know, that's a really good question, and I have to reiterate that it's very hard to predict which patient will respond to which medicine. I mean, we have a few rules where we avoid certain medicines and some people where we know it will get worse or not help, but in the end, we're left with like 10 different pills that we can choose from, and it's really hard to know which one will work. And sometimes one medicine doesn't work, but you need a combo of two medicines. So unfortunately, it sometimes really is trial and error. And that's sometimes the best that we can do is try one out, see if it works, and then if it doesn't, try something else. But we use educated decision making and picking the medicines one by one to do our best.
And is there any records or reports of what drugs have interactions with Vimpat, extremes or whatever?
You know, I think that's, I don't know if I can answer that question directly right now, but what I can tell you what a lot of pharmacies will do is if a patient's prescribed lacosamide, we have these automated programs that run checks between all the other medicines that the patient gets through that pharmacy and make sure that it doesn't interact. So if I order it on a patient, I get an alert in my that pops up on my screen when I order the medicine that says, oh, you're ordering Vimpat. Please make sure that the patient doesn't have this or this before you proceed. Or is it okay to give this even though they're on this drug? Sometimes there can be interaction. So a lot of pharmacies and medical centers are using programs like that to reduce the risk of giving something, making an error, basically.
Okay. I've been on Dilantin and phenobarbital pretty much all my life. I was about 5 years old. Is there any negative effects from being on those two drugs for so long? Some 30 years.
So yes and no. So, you know, the positive effects is if they are controlling seizures, that's great, and it's really important to be free of seizures. Negative effects. Well, we know that both of those medicines can cause problems with bone health when they're taken for more than 10 or 15 years in men and even for over 5 years in women. And so the biggest risk is osteoporosis. And weakening of the bones, and that can be checked with this bone scan pretty easily. And if it has occurred, you know, our options are to change medicines or to just add calcium and vitamin D to the things that you take every day to try to reduce that problem. And sometimes it can be a little more complicated than that. Also, some people get concerned that long-term use of phenobarbital can affect mood and memory, but I think that's also pretty individual. Coming off of a medicine like phenobarb after many, many years is actually really hard. So I would recommend that you have a meeting with a neurologist or your doctor about it and try to figure out if it's the right thing for you. And whether, if it's not controlling your seizures, whether there's a better option that will control them better.
Yeah, I have a doctor coming to my office about a year ago now, and that was one of the things he mentioned, the osteoporosis, bone weakening, those two drugs.
That also happens with the medicine called Tegretol as well. But again, you have to weigh the benefit of it controlling seizures with that risk and decide whether it's worth coming off of it or just making other adjustments. Can I actually see, is there anybody else who has a question?
And we're going to have to wrap up the call, Dr. Garga.
Okay.
I want to thank you for giving all the information you did today, and I hope everybody can join us for the next patient call that we'll be having in the near future. We'll be planning it and sending the information out.
Is that 3 months from now, or?
We will get it out as soon as we get a firm date.
And it's just a one-hour thing?
Yes, just 1 hour. That's it.
Or is it going to be like more question and answer time or what?
We'll discuss that when we're in our planning phase as far as what we're going to do with the next patient call, because this was the first one, so we were still new at it. Now we got some information and we can plan accordingly.
Well, I would ask that you request more time for the question and answer phase rather than just 15 minutes.
All right, we can do that. Thank you, Doctor.
Right, thank you.
Thanks for your feedback. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.